I welcome you again to the series this year entitled Great Decisions, continuing from last year. We're up to Great Decisions 11, Executing Eichmann, sponsored this year again, like last year, by Becky and Avikatz Le'ilu Nishmas Yona Ben Rabbi Leib, and I thank them for their sponsorship. So the capture and trial of Adolf Eichmann was easily one of the formative events of modern Israel, meaning Israel as it exists today. And it changed society in significant ways and was also enormously controversial for a number of reasons. In retrospect, you wonder what the controversy was about. It just seems so obvious, but not then. Israel was roundly condemned for violating Argentinian sovereignty, forced to make amends for the breach of diplomatic norms by encroaching on their territory. The decision to execute him was heavily criticized by foreigners, and some Jewish elitists as well. And Israel's right to try Eichmann itself was unclear. What was its jurisdiction in the matter? It didn't exist as a country when the crimes were being committed. How could Israel avoid the perception of a show trial if Eichmann's guilt was a foregone conclusion? Foregone because Israel would not have gone to the trouble of kidnapping him if he wasn't guilty. And yet the trial and its aftermath unleashed a new spirit in Israel. For the first time, Holocaust survivors, the majority of the witnesses at the trial, told their stories in public. It's no exaggeration to state that nascent Israel was embarrassed by the Holocaust survivors and established their organs of state and their security apparatus to distinguish modern Israel from what they saw as the haplessness and even shameful passivity of the victims and some of the survivors. That attitude changed now after the trial when Israel, the country, the people, became fully aware of the scope and the gruesomeness and the hopelessness of the Holocaust. It engendered warmer feelings towards the survivors, as well as a gritty determination to never again allow the Jewish people to become vulnerable to that extent and to rely for our survival only on ourselves. In that sense, it would serve as the backdrop to the Six-Day War just half a decade later. The whole perception of the Holocaust changed as a result of the trial, as did appreciation for the ordeal of the survivors. So who was this monster Eichmann, a plain-looking bureaucrat, family man, the banality of evil, as he was described by one somewhat tendentious reporter at the time? How did he become Israel's most wanted? How was he tracked down, apprehended, brought to Israel, tried? And what were the factors that were weighed by the court in deciding to execute him? What were even the two sides in Israeli society? So Adolf Eichmann was born in Germany in 1906. He was raised in Austria after World War I. In a macabre coincidence, both Eichmann and Hitler, Yimach Shemam, spent a good part of their childhoods in the same Austrian city of Linz, which is about 12 miles east of the village of Mauthausen. Both of them even went to the same high school, although years, about a decade and a half apart. Hitler was 17 years old, as he was long gone by the time Eichmann arrived, but it's a dubious distinction for a city to have really produced both of them. Interestingly, there's a radical leftist Israeli professor at Tel Aviv University, Shlomo Sand, who wrote a book years ago saying that the history of the Jewish people is a myth, and we're all descendants of the Khazars, etc. He was also born in Linz after the war. Maybe it's in something in the water there. Eichmann was a clerk and a salesman. He moved back to Germany in 1933, immediately joined the SS, first working at the new concentration camp Dachau, and then transferring to the SD, which was the security service of the SS. He married in 1935. His wife died only 20 years ago, lived in Germany for many, many years after going back from Argentina. He had four children, including his oldest, Klaus, whom we'll return to in a few moments. Eichmann became deeply involved in the matter of the Jews already in the late 30s. In 1937, he even visited the land of Israel, came to Haifa, in order to investigate the possibility of Germany expelling its Jews to the land of Israel. Nothing came of it. In fact, Eichmann was thrown out by the British. He enjoyed a series of promotions, rising to the rank of SS Obersturmbannführer, like the lieutenant colonel, in 1941. So in that capacity, his boss, Reinhard Heydrich, who was one of the chief organizers of Kristallnacht, Heydrich informed Eichmann already in the fall of 1941, 2 months after the Nazis invaded the Soviet Union, of the plans to exterminate the Jews of Europe. They first organized the Einsatzgruppen that shot to death tens of thousands of Jews in Ukraine, in Lithuania, and Russia. And later, in that capacity, Eichmann attended the Wannsee Conference on January 20th, 1942. It's a very beautiful setting. We visited a few months ago, right outside Berlin, in a villa that's on Lake Wannsee that was used as an SS vacation home. The meeting took all of 90 minutes. In 90 minutes, Heydrich chaired the meeting. About a dozen people attended in administrative or decision-making capacities. Les Mondes de Polling. In 90 minutes over lunch, they planned the extermination of every last Jew in Europe, numbering roughly 9 million Jews. In the end, about two-thirds were murdered, and Eichmann was the zealous organizer, constantly refining the methodology of slaughter. So Eichmann's official designation, his job title, was Transportation Administrator of the Final Solution to the Jewish Question, essentially the architect of the Holocaust. He was responsible for logistics, transporting Jews from across the Nazi Empire to the death camps in Poland. So, for example, Auschwitz was selected because it was, still is, a major railroad hub. You have tracks intersecting from all different parts of Poland right there. Eichmann was a diligent and pitiless professional in his participation in mass murder, personally directing, he went there, personally directing the deportation of Hungarian Jews in 1944, and even continuing after Himmler ordered him to stop and to begin the cover-up of Nazi war crimes in the fall of 1944. But Eichmann was cleverer than many of his supervisors, and he fled into hiding already at the end of 1944. He was arrested first by the Allies in 1945, although they did not know who he was. He concealed his identity, he escaped the hiding again, bounced around for a number of years. He always carried around with him a cyanide capsule, vowing to kill himself rather than be captured. For several years, Jewish partisan groups trailed him, hunted him down, but never found him. And Eichmann ultimately fled to Italy, and then through Odessa, finding his way to Argentina in 1950. There are persistent reports, as the archives open up, the reports multiply that he was aided in the rat line, called the escape from Europe, by the Vatican or by German groups, even by some American groups. There was no real international effort to find him. The reward for his life, for the decade and a half until the Israelis got him, was $20,000. His family joined him in 1952. Eichmann assumed the name Ricardo Clement, living right outside Buenos Aires. He took a number of factory jobs over the years, finally at the Mercedes-Benz factory in Buenos Aires, and he lived in the shadows, notwithstanding an extensive interview he gave in 1955 to a German journalist named Sasson, in which he gleefully expressed no regret over the millions that he helped murder. What about the Israelis? It's arguable how much the capture of Nazi war criminals was a priority for Israel in the early years of the state. The Mossad was focused on weapons procurement, on bringing refugees to Israel. Most of the major war criminals were already dead by 1948, tried and executed at Nuremberg, or committing suicide themselves. But the Mossad had a file on Eichmann from the very beginning of the state, and nonetheless the trail had grown dry by August 1948. I mentioned once there was an exhibit at Beit HaTfutzot. It was supposed to be for a few months. They extended to a year or half a year or 9 months in 2012 that we visited. An entire exhibit on the capture of Eichmann, where for the first time all the Mossad agents involved were identified and extolled. One of the things they have on display there was a memo from August 1948. Someone in the Mossad made a suggestion, should they abduct Eichmann's wife and children in order to flesh him out. With the handwritten sentence beneath that, "K'tov lo bevakasha, ma dakha mibchina ekronit bidvar tachnit shakazu." Let us know in principle what is your feeling about carrying this out. And nothing happened. Obviously it was rejected. In 1954, Simon Wiesenthal received the first confirmation of sorts that Eichmann was in Argentina, but no other information. The big break came, as these things often happen, purely by chance. Klaus Eichmann, Eichmann's oldest son, by that time he was early 20s, he was in dating mode and he befriended a German girl named Sylvia Hermann. Unbeknownst to him, she was Jewish. He didn't know that. Many Germans lived in Buenos Aires. They became friendly, and Klaus even used the name Eichmann, even though they were using the name Clement, to buttress his credentials. Dating her, he used the name Eichmann. She told her father, who contacted a friend of his, Dr. Fritz Bauer, who was the prosecutor, the district prosecutor in Hessen, Germany, and a Jew. He reported this to a Mossad agent that he knew. It was 1957. At first, the Mossad dismissed the report as unreliable. It took a few more years. By 1959, Mossad knew his name, his address, or they thought they knew his name, his address, 14 Garibaldi Street, his place of business, the Mercedes-Benz factory. They dispatched a series of agents over the years, conducted surveillance for more than a year, taking pictures of him from a variety of angles, using the more primitive forensics of the day. They compared the updated pictures scientifically to Eichmann's wartime picture and submitted to the scientists at the Mossad, and all this on display. And the investigator writes at the bottom, "Matzati esen nikudot hashvat zihui karov levadai." I found 10 indicators, 10 points of identification between the old Eichmann picture and the new one. And still there was a doubt. For all they knew, he disappeared. His wife remarried someone else. They didn't know. So again, ironically, the confirmation came in 1960 because their anniversary was in March. Here she is with this man, and they saw, staking out the place, that they were celebrating inside their house. And they realized that there's no reason why she would celebrate the anniversary of her first husband if she was with her second husband. So therefore, they knew already it was him. With that, and the surveillance continuing, a plan was hatched by the Mossad to seize Eichmann in Argentina. At the same time, they had a number of agents there ready to look for Joseph Mengele as well, the butcher of Auschwitz, the doctor. It was still controversial. There are security officials in the Mossad who protested the diversion of resources from fighting the Arabs to this quest for Eichmann. It was Ben-Gurion who signed on. Isser Harel, who was the head of the Mossad, agreed as well. A small group of agents, the active ones, were dispatched in late April 1960. Identities kept secret for decades, but now all identified. Most of them, if not all, were of European origin. Many had lost relatives in the Holocaust. The commander of the group was Rafi Eitan. Name sound familiar? 25 years later, he would become Jonathan Pollard's handler and then abandon him. So another woman who joined mid-operation early May was a religious woman, a Haredi, Yehudit Nisayel, a Haredi female Mossad agent, a Jewish refugee from the Netherlands, living in Israel, of course, and she was identified by the other agent. She always wore tichel. Not much with disguise, obviously, but she always wore tichel. The team arrived in Buenos Aires after a trip of several days. There were no direct flights between Israel and Argentina, using fake British and German passports, which, by the way, the events 2 years ago, the Mossad still does the same thing. Several safe houses were rented, along with a few cars. They rented a few cars because some of them kept breaking down. Interestingly, no one had remembered that the seasons are reversed in the southern hemisphere, so they brought only light clothing, and they had to buy heavier jackets when they got there. By this time, they knew Eichmann's every move. Like a good German, his routine was precise. He took the same bus from the same stop every morning at the same time, bus stop 80 yards from his house. He returned the same time on the same bus every night as well. After a week of refining the plan, they staked out his house on the evening of May 11, 1960, pulled their car to the side of the road, another car a block away, pulled the car to the side of the road with the hood up as if they were trying to make repairs, fix something. At the appointed time, of course, the bus didn't show. They waited 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes. You can't just sit on the side of the road on a street with your hood up for that long a period of time. After 20 minutes, the bus showed up, which is late. Eichmann exited, parted with a woman who was a regular commuter with him, and began walking alone to his house. One agent, Peter Malkin, Zvi Malkin, who later wrote a book entitled Eichmann in My Hands, his oldest sister, Fruma, and her children had been murdered in the Holocaust. He was designated to approach Eichmann from behind, and he did, and he said, and had practiced this before, un momentito, senor, one moment. He grabbed Eichmann's right arm. His arm was in his pocket. They feared he might have a revolver with him. He grabbed his right arm, wrestled him to the ground. He stuck a glove fist in Eichmann's mouth so he wouldn't be able to scream. A second member of the team lifted Eichmann into their rented Mercedes. Eichmann was told, ein Laut und du bist tot. One sound and you're dead. Eichmann was silent. Back at the safe house, Eichmann first hid behind two of the aliases he had used over the years, the Ricardo Clement and Otto Eckmann, and then he confessed his identity. He was conclusively identified because the agents had been given by Fritz Bauer Eichmann's SS file, scars, tattoos, and even the circumference of his skull. Throughout his interrogation, he claimed not to know Mengele's whereabouts. Eichmann was hit, and he even said at one point, will you kill me after I tell you? I just don't know. I can't tell you. Eichmann was hidden in the safe house for 9 days as the scheme to transport him from Argentina unfolded. It's very interesting. They didn't really have a clear method of extracting him from Argentina when they seized him. They had a rough plan, but it took days for that plan to unfold. Every aspect was dangerous. His family began looking for him immediately, of course, police, hospitals, morgue, the factory. When he failed to show up for work on May 12th, the next day, a Thursday, his wife went to the factory to see if he was held up the night before, and he was told, no, he didn't come in this morning, and he didn't show up on Friday, he's going to be fired. Later, they found his broken glasses in the ditch where he had been seized and held down, and they knew that he had been captured by someone. The escape plan was delegated by Isser Harel to Avram Shalom, who became the Mossad chief in the 1980s, also made the news in his own way in the 80s. Coincidentally, that week, Argentina celebrated its 150th anniversary, and that became a cover. For the very first time, an Israeli delegation was invited to join the celebrations. An El Al plane landed on May 19th with dignitaries, such as Abba Ibn, who spoke at the airport, spoke in Spanish, by the way. Members of the team went back and forth to the airport regularly so the guards would be familiar with them by face and not seek to search any of their vehicles. It'd be easy to leave, and indeed it worked out very well. On May 20th at night, it was a Friday night, Eichmann was drugged, dressed in an El Al uniform, given a fake picture ID with the name Ze'ev Zichroni, and was presented as an El Al steward who was ill. He had partied too much at the anniversary celebrations, and he couldn't talk or walk, and they had to carry him. Airport guards, now familiar by face with the drivers, waved them through. The plane was off several hours later and arrived in Israel after stopping in Senegal late afternoon, Sunday, May 22nd. At a special session of the Knesset the next day, 4 p.m., the Knesset was called without being told why they were being called. Ben-Gurion electrified them and the nation. Only a small handful of people outside the Mossad knew. Ben-Gurion announced dramatically that Eichmann was discovered. He said, Adolf Eichmann is already under arrest in Israel. He will be shortly placed on trial in Israel under the terms of the law for the trial of Nazis and their collaborators. The fallout was swift. The members of Knesset, the whole session was 4 minutes, 5 minutes. People were stunned, silent. Some sobbed. Some could not believe the report. Within minutes of just sitting there, the stunned silence, they broke into a standing ovation. One unfortunate consequence, Ben-Gurion made the error of announcing it before all the agents were back in Israel. Some were still in South America, were horrified to learn it was announced. They had left Argentina already, but in the end, all returned safely. The world reaction was less joyful. There were no details released by Ben-Gurion on how he was seized, from where he was seized. The abduction was condemned by many faux moralists, and you could hear today in the criticisms of Israel for current events the same types of contentions. The Washington Post, May 27, 1960, commented, "Anything connected with his indictment is tainted by lawlessness. Israel is doing a grave disservice to Jews of other nationalities." The New York Times incorrectly wrote that an Eichmann mistress had betrayed him, and then they editorialized, again condemning the abduction. No immoral or illegal act justifies another. The rule of law must protect even the most depraved criminal. That's the New York Times. Not much has changed. Well, think about it. Just a few days ago, we, the Americans, captured an Al-Qaeda fugitive after 15 years in Libya. Obviously a violation of Libyan sovereignty, but by now the treatment of terrorists in the world is, except when Israel does it, is much more accepted, and therefore don't expect any UN the Security Council meeting on this. Others reported, you have to love the media, others reported that the Israelis have found him in Kuwait, or they transported him from wherever by submarine. Within days, Argentina reacted furiously when they revealed that Eichmann had been abducted from Argentina. Ironic, because until that point, Argentina denied that Eichmann or any other Nazis were living there. It's like, you know, Assad denied having chemical weapons until he agreed, sort of, to relinquish them. That's believable. In June of 1960, Argentina demanded an apology, damages from Israel, expelled Israel's ambassador, declared him persona non grata, and indeed they brought their case to the UN Security Council. Israel's official position at the UN, as enunciated by the foreign minister, young woman, and Golda Meir, said that they had nothing to do with it. It was private individuals that went to Argentina, captured him, and then brought him to Israel. It's not really a government matter, and they're not involved. But she apologized for any offense. Council passed the resolution with American support, condemning Israel for its breach of international law. But by August, the matter was officially closed. Other questions would remain, and the controversies would become exacerbated. As I said at the beginning, the first question that everyone had to deal with, by what legal authority did Israel arrest and try Adolf Eichmann? Now this was one of his defenses at trial. Notwithstanding that he signed a release in Buenos Aires consenting to his rendition to Israel. But again, Israel didn't exist when his crimes were taking place. They had no standing to be prosecutors. In whose place are they standing? His primary lawyer, Eichmann's primary lawyer, Robert Servatius, a German who had defended Nazis at Nuremberg, that's a specialty in law, I guess, he argued as follows, exactly along those lines. How does Eichmann get to Israel? There was no Israel. He's in Argentina. You can't abduct someone and try them. You can't create laws after the fact either. So the trial was based on ex post facto law because he was being tried in Israel on the 1950 Chok L'Asiyat Din B'Natzim V'Ozreyem. The law to try Nazis and their collaborators. That's 1950. His crimes been ended in 1945. It's a classic ex post facto. The judges were all Jews. Three Jews. Servatius and Eichmann argue they obviously could not be objective. In fact, the three judges, Moshe Landau, Yitzhak Raveh, and Binyamin Halevi had sat at the trial of Kastner also a few years earlier. They were all German-born. Landau was born in Danzig, which was then in Prussia. He was abducted against his will. So you had all these legal hurdles that were raised. On some level, they're logical, but obviously they lack gravitas compared to the seriousness, the enormity of the crimes of Adolf Eichmann. Some wanted the trial moved out of Israel to Germany. And the West Germans themselves were in a panic that the identities of ex-Nazis, some of whom were serving in the government of Konrad Adenauer, would be revealed if there was a trial. The Israelis, for their own reasons, kept the focus only on Eichmann and no other Nazis, and the fact they were rewarded in 1962 with substantial military assistance from the West German government. Was there a connection? Officially not. Unofficially? Likely. General Telford Taylor, who at one time was a chief U.S. prosecutor at the Nuremberg. In fact, he was my and my brother's constitutional law professor in law school. Real patrician. You know, had a dour appearance, a real stickler, very dignified, always stood like a general, even when he taught constitutional law. He argued that Israel had no jurisdiction in the matter. He said, saying simply, writing in fact, the crimes did not take place in Israel, and Eichmann was captured against his will. How could they do it? Nachum Goldin, who was head of an organization, World Zionist Congress, pleaded for an international court to try Eichmann anywhere but Israel, feeling that it would just make Jews look bad. All these claims were rejected. And with the most substantive, the ex post facto argument dismissed on the grounds that such a principle exists not as a legal mandate, but simply because justice demands that a person not be prosecuted for something that was not a crime officially when it was committed. But these were crimes. In any event, the trial was Israel's equivalent of the Nuremberg trials, where many of the same issues had been raised and dismissed. Obviously, if you think back to Nuremberg, they were all charged with genocide, a word that was not even invented until 1942. This was a classic ex post facto. The prosecutor here in Israel quoted Professor Goodhart of Oxford, who justified the legal authority of Nuremberg as follows. He said, what's their argument? I quote, as no man can be a judge in his own case, so no allied tribunal can be a judge in a case in which members of the enemy government or forces are on trial. Attractive as this argument may sound in theory, it ignores the fact that it runs counter to the administration of law in every country. If it were true, then no spy could ever be given a legal trial, because his case is always heard by judges representing the enemy country. Yet no one has ever argued that in such cases it was necessary to call neutral judges. The prisoner has the right to demand that his judges shall be fair, but not that they shall be neutral. All the initial arguments were rejected. The trial began about 11 months after Eichmann's capture, May 11, 1961, lasted 4 months, took place in Yerushalayim in a special courtroom that was erected in Beit Ha'am on Rehov Bitzalel in Nachlaot, the stone's throw from Rechavia. The building still exists today. It's a cultural center called the Gerard Bechar Center. Gerard Bechar. Bechar's father was a French writer. He wrote a check, and so they named the building after the family. Eichmann was charged under Israeli law now with crimes against humanity, crimes against the Jewish people, war crimes, etc. As is well known, he stood in a glass booth to protect him from any assaults, surrounded by two guards, listening in on by translation. The chief prosecutor was Gideon Hausner, who was born in Lvov, in Lemberg, was Israel's attorney general, later Knesset member, cabinet member, longtime chair of Yad Vashem. He wrote the definitive volume at the time, Justice in Jerusalem. He opened with a very powerful and legendary statement, and at the exhibit, Beit HaTfutzot, it and some of the testimonies playing on a loop of different screens, just heard it over and over again. Powerful words, I'll read part of it to you, his opening statement. B'makom bo ani omei lefneichem shoftei Yisrael. When I stand before you here, judges of Israel, l'lamed kategoria al Adolf Eichmann, to lead the prosecution of Eichmann, eneni omei yichidi, I'm not standing alone. Standing with me at this time are 6 million prosecutors. They cannot stand on their feet. They can't stand and point an accusing finger at the glass booth and cry towards the one sitting there, I accuse you. Because their ashes are piled up on the hills of Auschwitz, the fields of Treblinka, Nishaf ben Arot Polin, they are strewn in the forests of Poland, and their ashes are, their graves are scattered about the face of Europe by length and width. Damam zoeik, their blood cries out. Ach kolam lo yishama, their voice cannot be heard. Ehyeh al kein ani lahem lepeh, I therefore will be for them the mouth. Vagid b'shemam et dvar ha'yishuma nora, and in their name I will unfold the awesome indictment. Then he went on, and the truth is, it's haunting to hear it even now, again and again. And he went on, I'll just read the English for you. The history of the Jewish people is steeped in suffering and tears. B'damai chayi, Yecheskel, in your blood we shall live, is the imperative that has confronted this nation ever since it made its first appearance on the stage of history. Paro and Egypt decided to afflict them with their burdens, to cast their sons in the river. Haman's decree, Lashmid, Larog, Labed. Chmelnytsky slaughtered them in multitudes. They were butchered in Petlura's pogroms. Petlura was the head of Ukraine who spearheaded pogroms against the Jews after the Russian Revolution. Killed 1919, 1920, between 35 and 50,000 Jews. He himself was killed by a Jew in 1926. How is it continues? Yet never, down in the entire blood-stained road traveled by this people, never since the first days of its nationhood, has any man arisen who succeeded in dealing it such grievous blows as did Hitler's iniquitous regime and Adolf Eichmann as its executive arm for the extermination of the Jewish people. In all human history, there's no other example of a man against whom it would be possible to draw up such a bill of indictment as has been read here. The most terrible crimes are those fearful figures of barbarism and bloodlust, Genghis Khan, Attila, Ivan the Terrible, the telling of which curdles our blood, makes our hair stand on end with horror, deeds that have become l'mashog l'shnina, a proverb and a taunt, the pasuk in Yirmiyahu, l'diron olam, everlasting disgrace to the nations. These almost seem to pale into insignificance when contrasted with the abominations, the murderous horrors which will be presented to you in this trial. Proceedings were televised, riveting. About 100 people testified, out of many more who wanted to testify, mostly survivors, some of whom had even come face to face with Eichmann, others had no idea during the war who he was. Some were famous. Abba Kovner, one of the partisan leaders in the Vilna ghetto, a writer. Yechiel Denur, insisted being called by his name, Katsetnik, his camp name, as if he's the Soma camp. Famously, you see the loop also, He fainted in the middle of his testimony, and his description of Auschwitz as the place is another planet, unrelated to life in a normal world. He fainted at that time. Some Germans testified, adducing statements from several of the executed Nazi war criminals, like Göring, who said that Eichmann masterminded the whole Final Solution. 1,600 documents were admitted into evidence as well. It was powerful and educational, and Hausner made the trial into a history lesson and a record of the Holocaust. Israelis heard stories they never heard before, and the world heard of the brutality and inhumanity firsthand. Eichmann's defense was much like his initial statements upon his arrest. He testified it was his Auftrag zur Folgen. It was his job to do. He just carried out orders. He never did anything without advance express instructions from Hitler and his superiors. By the way, that was not true. And there are witnesses and documents that proved it was not true. At times, he defied orders. Eichmann said, when he testified, to obey is the highest command. And he said his preferred plan was forced immigration, even referencing his trip to Israel in the 30s, not extermination. He conceded guilt, he said, in the human sense, but not legally. And nonetheless, on cross-examination, he did admit, saying in 1955 to the reporter, that he would go to his grave laughing, that he had killed millions of people. For me, he said, a source of extraordinary satisfaction. For most, Eichmann wasn't banal at all, but ruthless, mechanical, supercilious, and the embodiment of Nazi evil. On December 11, 1961, Eichmann was found guilty. December 15th, he was sentenced to death by hanging. He appealed both the verdict and the death sentence. All sane people believed he was guilty, but regarding capital punishment, he had unlikely defenders. Maybe not so unlikely. What's halacha? In a sefer entitled Chikrei Yahadut, written by Rabbi Dr. Shimon Federbusch, you may have heard the name, he was the chief rabbi of Finland, and he became mechanech here in America, and he was the grandfather of our own David Federbusch, he wrote the halachic justification for the Eichmann trial. A number of areas, I gave assurance a few years ago, if the din of Goel Hadam. So Goel Adam, the blood avenger, is usually a relative, but in fact, halacha is, he quotes the Rambam, even if there are no relatives, the Beis Din becomes the Goel Adam. The Beis Din can appoint the Goel Adam. There's a Din Melech, a Din Malchus, that's almost an extrajudicial punishment, allows for justice outside the framework of Beis Din for the good of society. There's a Din of a Yoresh, and Israel's the natural Yoresh, the heir of all the victims who were murdered. The need for Tikkun HaChevra is paramount, and that really is the reason for capital punishment in the Jewish system. It's not vengeance, it's that society needs it. Uvi'arta haram mikirbecha, you have to burn out the evil from its midst. And of course, the only following orders defense has no standing in halacha at all. Gemara says a kiddush, not ben beis, but beis. Elsewhere as well, divrei harav, the divrei hatalmid, divrei mishomim. The master commands, God, and the disciple commands, to whom do you listen? Listen to the master. It's a lesson that Adam HaRishon learned. It's the first lesson human beings have to learn. Only following orders is not a defense. Famous liberal Jews rallied against the death penalty. Among them, Martin Buber, the philosopher, Gershon Scholem, who was the popularizer of the Jewish mysticism, Yeshayahu Leibovich, another big liberal. Buber himself met with Ben-Gurion. Ben-Gurion actually went to see him in Buber's house, because he said, Buber's older, it's only kavod to go to him. Buber told Ben-Gurion, we don't want the enemy to turn us into hangmen. That's not what Jews are. If that happens, they will be the victors. These arguments still resonate today. He said, executing Eichmann will allow the world to believe that all is forgiven, as if one execution can compensate for 6 million dead. And then he added that undoubtedly it'll provoke a wave of Jew hatred across the world. And so don't execute him. Imprison him. One survivor responded to Buber you can forgive the murder of your parents. Don't tell me I have to forgive the murder of my parents. There are appeals from religious figures across the world, although very interestingly, I did not find in any source that, unlike what we've grown accustomed to the last few decades, I saw no source that said the Vatican appealed for clemency for Eichmann. Remember, the Vatican was then controlled by Pope John the 23rd, who really had guilt over the Holocaust and tried to make amends for it. Walter Kaufman, very well known professor of philosophy at Princeton, wrote to Ben-Gurion, "We Jews should show our genius and let him go." Genius. Others criticized what they saw as Old Testament ethics. You know, Jews again, eye for an eye. The Israeli media, a rarity, was uniformly supportive of execution across the board. And Mariv taunted the Argentinians who kept requesting repatriation and said he should be tried to serve a sentence in Argentina. We'll take care of him. We would have arrested him had you told us. Mariv editorialized, "Our dear friends, are you really sure you would have arrested Eichmann at the request of the Israeli government? Really? Really?" Most German newspapers supported Israel. And Hausner, during this period of time and after, received numerous letters from young Israelis thanking him. They never knew. One teenage girl wrote, I mean, it's quite moving, "Now I know why I have no aunts and uncles. My parents would just tell me they all died." Then she realized how they died. Nazis threatened Hausner. Neo-Nazis threatened. Threatened Israel as well. If Eichmann were executed, one German wrote to Hausner, "Why are you reopening old wounds?" 15 years after Holocaust, 17 years. "We are not all Nazis. Now again the world will think we're all Nazis." On the other side of the coin, many Germans also agreed. One writing to Hausner, "No punishment is enough." There are few events until real modern times that attracted so much international attention with such diversity of views. Some who were critical of the capture praised the conduct of the trial. Even Eichmann's lawyer, Servatius, conceded in argument, appellate argument, that the trial was fair. Telford Taylor, an old professor, who had been harshly critical of the abduction and who attended part of the trial, recanted some of his earlier objections and wrote that he was impressed by the integrity and the dignity of the proceedings. Gallup poll in America showed what percentage of Americans supported execution? 62%. Seems high, but you'd think it would be even higher than that. Maybe there was a good part of the survey sample that just had no opinion or didn't know what they were talking about. The New York Herald Tribune editorialized, "Execution will be an act of justice and an act of remembrance." And El Mundo, the Spanish newspaper, praised Israel for its restraint in not just killing Eichmann on the spot and for the honesty of the proceedings. And yet on the other side, the Daily Herald of London, later, after he was killed, unctuously opined, and listen to this, because again, these words echo today, "By executing Eichmann, Israel carried out an act of understandable political necessity. If Eichmann's life were spared, it would have been the greatest act of clemency in the history of the world. And because we still think of Jews as a chosen people of unique moral purpose, we dare to hope they would act differently." Stuck. We're disappointed in the Jews that they couldn't rise above this type of vengeance. That same phoniness and hypocrisy, oleaginous hypocrisy, is what enables the same mindset to condemn Israel for defending itself every time Israel has to defend itself, as if we should show that we're better by dying and not responding. On May 29, 1962, the Israeli Appeals Court, five justices, upheld the verdict and sentence. Before they read the decision, before Moshe Silver, the presiding justice, read the decision, the Sgan, Shimon Agrinat, another name that will recur even this year, 12 years later, he would head the commission that investigated the Yom Kippur War debacle. Agrinat took on the ex post facto argument, and he said to apply it here, because he was raised on appeal, to apply it here would lack all moral foundation and cause an injustice. And he said as well, the circumstances of Eichmann's capture was also just, because, I quote, Eichmann had committed international crimes and was therefore a fugitive from justice under the law of nations. So in essence, any nation had the right and obligation to detain him. That day, when the court turned down his appeal, Eichmann filed an appeal for clemency with the president, Yitzhak Ben Zvi, the last option. Same day, Ben-Gurion called a special cabinet meeting to discuss whether they should recommend clemency to the president. There was a fierce debate in the cabinet. I don't know if it's widely known. Initially, two cabinet ministers opposed execution. One was Levi Eshkol, became a prime minister after Ben-Gurion, and the second was Yosef Gur, who was a real liberal, the longtime head of the Mafdal. They claimed, Burg said, the greater torture would be to keep him in a cell the rest of his life. And Eshkol said, let him walk around with the Ot Kayin, the mark of Cain, on his head. But they were the only two. The others attacked them vehemently. Dov Yosef, who was in the Minister of Justice, he'd have to make the formal recommendation. He decried the entire meeting. Remember, Dov Yosef had been the mayor of Yerushalayim during the War of Independence. He said the Nuremberg trials result in the execution of 77 people. No one said a word. So now when the Jewish people do the same thing, it's illegitimate. We have to respond to criticism across the world. Golda Meir, as foreign minister, agreed. She said, if the Poles could hang Rudolf Hoss, who was the commandant at Auschwitz, and the Norwegians could hang Quisling, the Jews could hang Eichmann. The cabinet voted. All but two favored execution. The two, Eshkol and Burg, voted for clemency, at which point, as he was wont to do, remember last year at the decision to declare the state, Ben-Gurion asked for a re-vote, so the final decision should be unanimous. And at that point, Eshkol and Burg withdrew their objections, and it was unanimous. They decided then as well that Eichmann's body would be cremated, the ashes scattered outside Israel's territorial waters. There'd be no grave, no shrine, and of course no remains of that fiend in Israel. On May 31st, President Ben Zvi rejected Eichmann's petition, which was based on compassion for his wife and children, and it was such an exquisite sense of timing and historical, biblical perspective. Ben Zvi wrote on the words of the petition itself, the words of Shmuel Hanavi, the words with which Shmuel Hanavi had rejected Agag Melech Amalek's petition. Kasher shiklod nashim charbecha, king tishkal minashim imecha. Just like your sword made women bereaved, so too may your mother be bereaved among women. That same night, 7 p.m., Eichmann was told to be executed in a few hours. He wrote letters to his wife and children. His wife actually had visited him a few months earlier, spirited in and out of Israel before the public knew she was there. And she always maintained his innocence to her grave. He was visited by a minister who had sought him out. He was unrepentant to the end. The prison service, the Shabbat Shirut by Sohar, chose two Sfaradim to carry out the execution, so they should not be accused of having Europeans do it. One of them, you know, visits our shul regularly, Shalom Nagar, Boaz's father. Eichmann received his last meal in the Ramla prison, including a bottle of Carmel white wine. He shaved and brushed his teeth. Before midnight, he was walked to the execution chamber. Among the witnesses was Rafi Eitan, who had led the Mossad team that captured Eichmann. Eichmann stared at Eitan and said to him coldly, I hope very much that it will be your turn soon after mine. That wish was not granted. More than 50 years later, Rafi Eitan is still alive. Eichmann declined the hood, he was robed, said, long live Germany, long live Argentina, long live Austria. I had to obey the laws of war and flag, and I am ready. After babbling about his belief in God, Nagar, Shaul Nagar, and his colleague pressed buttons, only one worked. Trap door open, Eichmann's body fell 10 feet. Minutes later, he was dead. As Reb Shalom tells the story, he went with his colleague to release the body. As he carried the corpse, air was expelled from Eichmann's lungs, nearly frightening Reb Shalom to death. He had nightmares for many years because he thought he wasn't really dead. The body was put in a specially crafted furnace. Among the witnesses with Eitan, who helped carry the body into the furnace, was a Mossadik named Goldman, one of the officers of the Bureau that tracked him down. As the minister related, when he reached to put his body in, Goldman's Auschwitz tattoo was visible on his forearm as he stuck him in the furnace. Overnight, the ashes were taken to Yafo, a boat carried them outside Israel's territorial waters, and they were unceremoniously, he didn't want a Christian service, unceremoniously scattered in the Mediterranean. Before dawn, the boat was back at shore, and it was done. In the Arab press, Eichmann was hailed as a martyr. In Israel, the trial was revolutionary. Elie Wiesel covered the trial as a reporter, wrote about its importance for both reasons of justice and education. Holocaust consciousness was raised, and the term itself became part of the lexicon thereafter. It was the pride of the capture and a small sense of vindication, but the trail of other Nazis grew colder, and the Mossad quickly turned its attention to other matters, and they never really launched another search for Nazi war criminals across the world. A few years ago, it was 2 years ago actually, Hausner's daughter, he died in 1989, I think. Hausner's daughter is a lawyer, Tommy Raveh Hausner, spoke about her recollections of her father and the time, and she said that she feels that if it happened today, Eichmann would not be executed. The pressure would have been unbearable. Israel might not be able to tolerate it. World sympathy has shifted, and so has Israel. One only has to recall the trial of John Demjanjuk, who was tried, convicted, sentenced to death for being Ivan the Terrible of Treblinka, and then, to summarize in a nutshell, had his conviction reversed on appeal on the grounds that he was actually Ivan the Pretty Bad of Sobibor. That was defense. He couldn't have killed Jews at Treblinka because he was killing Jews at Sobibor. And the Israelis freed him, decided not to retry him. The Germans eventually did. He actually died in Germany after being convicted of being an accessory to murder. Another illustration of the changes in Israeli society, Demjanjuk was defended not by non-Jewish German lawyers, as was Eichmann, but by Israeli Jewish lawyers, one of whom was the subject of an acid attack during the trial. It was unthinkable in 1961 that even a Jewish lawyer should defend Adolf Eichmann. Not anymore. And Eichmann today, if he wasn't executed and was still in prison, who knows if he wouldn't have been released in a prisoner exchange at some point. That seems to be the custom. And after all, Eichmann apparently never actually killed anybody with his own hands. The tale of his capture unfolded slowly over the years. The agents, Kedarkom, had very little to say. Peter Malkin, who had seized him at first, and whose sister Fruma and children had been murdered. He returned home after the capture, went to his mother's house for Shabbos, as he often did, he wasn't married yet, pretended to know nothing. His own children had no idea until the government began publicizing the story in the 1970s. Until then, they thought he was a government clerk with a dull job. He told his mother he was in Paris on government business, and that was it. She knew nothing. Only one time did he open up. It's a very powerful story. 5 years later, 1967, Malkin rushed home from assignment in Athens when his mother fell critically ill. He arrived at the hospital in Haifa, She lay unresponsive in the hospital. He was denied entry because he went right from the airport. It was the middle of the night, and at the front door they told him it's not visiting hours.
Okay.
As was his way, he just climbed the wall on the outside and sneaked in through a second floor window and went to his mother's room. His mother lay there, ashen, white face, not moving at all. He took her hand and he said to Mama, it's me, Peter. No response. The woman in the next bed said to him in Yiddish, Erendit. She doesn't talk at all. He continued, Mom, I want to tell you something. What I promised, this was after the war, what I promised I have done, I captured Eichmann. No response. He said, Mama, Fruma was avenged. It was her brother who captured Eichmann. And the woman in the next bed said, quiet, she doesn't hear anything. At which point, Mrs. Malkin squeezed his hand. And he said again, do you understand? I captured Eichmann. She opened her eyes and whispered, yeah, yes, I understand. And she went back to sleep. I thank you all for coming. Next time we'll discuss the issue of Jewish identity, of who is a Jew in its early years in the 1960s. Look at that, Machlokas. Next time is 2 weeks, by the way, not next week. Thank you.